Sparks of history, sudden and startling events, can arise in any turning. Some sparks ignite nothing. Some flare briefly and then extinguish. Some have important effects but leave underlying problems unresolved. Others ignite epic conflagrations. Which ones ignite? Studying the sparks of history themselves won't help answer this question, because what they are is far less important than how a society reacts to them. That reaction is substantially determined by the season of the saeculum, in other words, by the turning in which they are located. Sparks in a high tend to reinforce feelings of security. In an awakening, argument. In an unraveling, anxiety. Come the fourth turning, sparks of history trigger a fierce new dynamic of public synergy and public action. Each of these sparks is linked to a specific threat about which society had been fully informed, but against which it had left itself poorly protected. Afterward, the fact that these sparks were foreseeable but poorly foreseen gives rise to a new sense of urgency about institutional dysfunction and civic vulnerability. This marks the beginning of the vertiginous spiral of crisis. Once this new mood is fully catalyzed, a society begins the process of regeneracy, a drawing together into whatever definition of community is available at the time. Collective action is now seen as vital to solving the society's most fundamental problems. Societal problems that, in the unraveling, posed insuperable dilemmas, now appear to have simple, if demanding, solutions. A new resolve about urgent public goals crowds out qualms about questionable public means. Private life also transforms beyond prior recognition. Now less important than the team, individuals are expected to comply with new fourth-turning standards of virtue. Family order strengthens, and personal violence and substance abuse decline. Those who persist in freewheeling, self-oriented behavior now face implacable public stigma, even punishment. Winner-take-all arrangements give way to enforceable new mechanisms of societal sharing. Questions about who does what are settled on grounds of survival, not fairness. This leads to a renewed social division of labor by age and sex. In the realm of public activity, elders are expected to step aside for the young, women for men. When danger looms, children are expected to be protected before parents, mothers before fathers. All social arrangements are evaluated anew. Pre-crisis promises and expectations count for little. Where the unraveling had been an era of fast-paced personal lives against a background of public gridlock, in the crisis, the pace of daily life will seem to slow down, just as political and social change accelerates. When society approaches the climax of a crisis, it reaches a point of maximum civic power. Where the new values regime had once justified individual fury, it now justifies public fury. Wars become more likely and are fought with efficacy and finality. The risk of revolution or civil war is high, as the community that commands the greatest loyalty does not necessarily coincide with political or geographic boundaries. Leaders become more inclined to define enemies in moral terms, to enforce virtue militarily, to refuse all compromise, to commit larger forces in that effort, to impose heavy sacrifices on the battlefield and home front, to build the most destructive weapons contemporary minds can imagine, and to deploy those weapons if needed to obtain an enduring victory. The crisis climax is human history's equivalent to nature's raging typhoon, the kind that sucks all surrounding matter into a single swirl of ferocious energy. The climax shakes a society to its roots, transforms its institutions, redirects its purposes, and marks its people and its generations for life. The climax can end in triumph, or tragedy, or some combination of both. Whatever the event and whatever the outcome, society passes through a great gate of history, fundamentally altering the course of civilization. Soon thereafter, this great gate is sealed by the crisis resolution, when victors are rewarded and enemies punished, when empires or nations are forged or destroyed, when treaties are signed and boundaries redrawn, when peace is accepted, troops repatriated, and life begun anew. One large chapter of history ends, and another starts. In a very real sense, one society dies, and another is born. Once every seculum, the archetypes reach a combustible combination, dramatically lowering the threshold for a spark of history to ignite a crisis. This archetypal lineup has been one of the great constants of Anglo-American history. The indulged prophet children of Highs, born in the aftermath of one crisis, have fomented the next crisis upon entering elderhood. The abandoned nomad children of Awakenings have become the pragmatic midlife managers of crisis. The protected hero children of Unravelings have provided the powerful young adult soldiers of crisis. The suffocated children of crises have come of age afterward as artist youths. Earlier, we explained how crisis eras shape generations. Now you see how generations shape crises. This explains the underlying link between the cycles of history and the rhythms of the natural saeculum. While all generational transitions are important to create a fourth-turning constellation, the aging of the prophet is critical. A crisis catalyst occurs shortly after the old prophet archetype reaches its apex of societal leadership, when its inclinations are least checked by others. A regeneracy comes as the prophet abandons any idea of deferral or retreat and binds the society to a crisis course. A climax occurs when the prophet expends its last burst of passion just before descending rapidly from power. A resolution comes with the prophet's symbolic assistance at a time when the nomad is asserting full control. Here is what history teaches about the four life cycle phases and archetypes in turn. As prophet generations enter elderhood, their passion for principle leads beyond the point of no return. No longer are their crusades mostly symbolic, now they require a last act urgency. As the crisis erupts, their cultural arguments coalesce around a new vision of community. They trade material security for moral authority, and translate their lifelong values agenda into commandments that exact sacrifice from them and others. When the crisis hits, nomad generations find their lives painfully split between the old order and new. But they rise fiercely and sacrificially to the occasion, able to make hard and fast choices without fretting about what others think. Midlife nomads forge an effective alliance with the elder prophets. Whatever happens, they find that others are quick to blame them and slow to give them credit. Coming of age, hero generations develop a strong ethos of constructive activity, a peer-enforced code of dutiful conduct, and an overwhelming sense of generational community. Instinctive doers and team players, they gravitate toward social goals and human relationships that can be clearly defined. They expect and receive challenges from older generations. They band together on command. Artists enter childhood surrounded by no-nonsense adults who fiercely protect, even envelop them at a time when mighty events are deciding the fate of nations. Children are expected to be obedient, stay out of harm's way, and let adults do important work. This fosters an anxiety about how, or if, they can ever live up to the expectations of powerful elders who are sacrificing so much on their behalf. A fourth turning provides passage through the great discontinuities of history and closes the full circle of the saeculum. Another crisis era is coming, and soon. With history as our guide, there is much that we can foresee about what may happen. Sometime around the year 2005, perhaps a few years before or after, America will enter the fourth turning. In the middle 00s, America will be a very different society than in the late 1920s when the last crisis catalyzed. The nation will be more affluent, be in better health, have more technology, possess a larger and more diverse population, and command more powerful weapons. But the same could be said about every other unraveling era society compared to its predecessor. They were not exempt from the saeculum, nor will we be. A spark will ignite a new mood. Today, the same spark would flame briefly but then extinguish, its last flicker merely confirming and deepening the unraveling era mindset. This time, though, it will catalyze a crisis. In retrospect, the spark might seem as ominous as a financial crash, as ordinary as a national election, or as trivial as a tea party. It could be a rapid succession of small events in which the ominous, the ordinary, and the trivial are commingled. A crisis catalyst involves scenarios distinctly imaginable 8 or 10 years in advance. Based on recent unraveling era trends, the following circa 2005 scenarios might seem plausible. Beset by a fiscal crisis, a state lays claim to its residents' federal tax monies. Declaring this an act of secession, the president obtains a federal injunction. The governor refuses to back down. Federal marshals enforce a court order. Similar tax rebellions spring up in other states. Treasury bill auctions are suspended. Militia violence breaks out. Cyber terrorists destroy IRS databases. U.S. Special Forces are put on alert. Demands issue for a new constitutional convention. Or suppose a global terrorist group blows up an aircraft and announces it possesses portable nuclear weapons. The United States and its allies launch a preemptive strike. The terrorists threaten to retaliate against an American city. Congress declares war and authorizes unlimited house-to-house searches. Opponents charge that the president concocted the whole emergency for political purposes. A nationwide strike is declared. Foreign capital flees the United States. Or imagine an impasse over the federal budget reaching a stalemate. The president and Congress both refuse to back down, triggering a near-total government shutdown. The president declares emergency powers. Congress rescinds his authority. Dollar and bond prices plummet. The president threatens to stop Social Security checks. Congress refuses to raise the debt ceiling. Default looms. Wall Street panics. Or picture the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announcing the spread of a new communicable virus. The disease reaches densely populated areas, killing some. Congress enacts mandatory quarantine measures. The president orders the National Guard to throw prophylactic cordons around unsafe neighborhoods. Mayors resist. Urban gangs battle suburban militias. Calls mount for the president to declare martial law. Lastly, suppose growing anarchy throughout the former Soviet republics prompts Russia to conduct training exercises around its borders. Lithuania erupts in civil war. Poland dissolves its parliament. U.S. diplomats are captured and publicly taunted. The president airlifts troops to rescue them and orders ships into the Baltic Sea. Iran declares its alliance with Russia. Oil prices soar. Congress debates restoring the draft. It's highly unlikely that any one of these scenarios will actually happen. What is likely, however, is that the catalyst will unfold according to a basic crisis dynamic that underlies all of these scenarios. An initial spark will trigger a chain reaction of unyielding responses and further emergencies. The core elements of these scenarios, debt, civic decay, global disorder, will matter more than the details, which the catalyst will juxtapose and connect in some unknowable way. If foreign societies are also entering a fourth turning, this could accelerate the chain reaction. At home and abroad, these events will reflect the tearing of the civic fabric at points of extreme vulnerability, problem areas where, during the unraveling, America will have neglected, denied, or delayed needed action. Anger at mistakes we made will translate into calls for action, regardless of the heightened public risk. It is unlikely that the catalyst will worsen into a full-fledged catastrophe, since the nation will probably find a way to avert the initial danger and stabilize the situation for a while. The local rebellions will probably be quelled, terrorists foiled, fiscal crisis averted, disease halted, or war fever cooled. Yet even if dire consequences are temporarily averted, America will have entered the fourth turning. The new mood and its jarring new problems will provide a natural endpoint for the unraveling era decline in civic confidence. In the pre-crisis years, fears about the flimsiness of the social contract will have been subliminal but rising. As the crisis catalyzes, these fears will rush to the surface, jagged and exposed. Distrustful of some things, individuals will feel that their survival requires them to distrust more things. This behavior could cascade into a sudden downward spiral, an implosion of societal trust. If so, this implosion will strike financial markets, and with that, the economy. Aggressive individualism, institutional decay, and long-term pessimism can proceed only so far before a society loses the level of dependability needed to sustain the division of labor and the long-term promises on which a market economy must rest. Through the unraveling, people will have preferred, or at least tolerated, the exciting, if bewildering, trend towards social complexity. But as the crisis mood congeals, people will come to the jarring realization that they have grown helplessly dependent on a teetering edifice of anonymous transactions and paper guarantees. people won't know where their savings are, who their employer is, what their pension is, or how their government works. The era will have left the financial world arbitraged and tentacled. Debtors won't know who holds their notes, homeowners who owns their mortgages, and shareholders who runs their equities, and vice versa. At about the same time, each generation's approach to its new phase of life will set off loud economic alarms, reminding people how weakly their unraveling era nation prepared for the future. The boomers' old age will loom, exposing the thinness in private savings and the unsustainability of public promises. The 13ers will reach their make-or-break peak earning years, realizing at last that they can't all be lucky exceptions to their stagnating average income. Millennials will come of age facing debts, tax burdens, and two-tier wage structures that older generations will now declare intolerable. As all these generations enter their crisis constellation, the unraveling will have left the government so fiscally overcommitted to sustaining everyone's expectations that initial official responses to these new concerns will lack credibility. Subliminal fears will now become urgent. The unraveling era's wry acceptance that people might never get much back from Social Security will crystallize into a jolting new fear that everything from treasury bills to remortgage instruments to mutual funds could become just as suspect. At some point, America's short-term crisis psychology will catch up to the long-term post-unraveling fundamentals. This might result in a great devaluation, a severe drop in the market price of most financial and real assets. This devaluation could be a short but horrific panic, a free-falling price in a market with no buyers. Or it could be a series of downward ratchets linked to political events that sequentially knock the supports out from under the residual popular trust in the system. With savings worth less, the new elders will become more dependent on government, just as government becomes less able to pay benefits to them. With taxes hiked, the new midlifers will get to pocket even less of their peak year incomes. With job offers dwindling, the new youth will face even taller barricades against their future. Before long, America's old civic order will seem ruined beyond repair. People will feel like a magnet has passed over society's disk drive, blanking out the social contract, wiping out old deals, clearing the books of vast unpayable promises to which people had once felt entitled. The economy could reach a trough that may look to be the start of a depression. With American weakness newly exposed, foreign dangers could erupt. From this trough and from these dangers, the makings of a new social contract and new civic order will arise. In the initial jerry-built stages, people will not be entitled but authorized to receive whatever they get from government. This will lead to conflict as people do battle to establish where, how, and by whom this authority is to be exercised. This battle could be peaceful, involving political processes, or violent, involving public and private militias. Soon after the catalyst, a national election will produce a sweeping political realignment as one faction or coalition capitalizes on a new public demand for decisive action. Republicans, Democrats, or perhaps a new party will decisively win the long partisan tug of war, ending the era of split government that had lasted through four decades of awakening and unraveling. The winners will now have the power to pursue the more potent, less incrementalist agenda about which they had long dreamed and against which their adversaries had darkly warned. This new regime will enthrone itself for the duration of the crisis. Regardless of its ideology, this new leadership will assert public authority and demand private sacrifice. Where leaders had once been inclined to alleviate societal pressures, they will now aggravate them to command the nation's attention. The regeneracy will be solidly underway. In foreign affairs, America's initial fourth-turning instinct will be to look away from other countries and focus total energy on the domestic birth of a new order. Later, provoked by real or imagined outside provocations, the society will turn newly martial. America will become more isolationist than today in its unwillingness to coordinate its affairs with other countries, but less isolationist in its insistence that vital national interests not be compromised. The crisis mood will dim expectations that multilateral diplomacy and expanding global democracy can keep the world out of trouble. Even before any conflicts arise, people will feel less anxiety over the prospect of casualties. The economy will in time recover from its early and vertiginous reversals. Late in the crisis, with trust and hope and urgency growing fast, it may even achieve unprecedented levels of efficiency and production. But by then, the economy will have changed fundamentally. Compared to today, it will be less globally dependent, with smaller cross-border trade and capital flows. Its businesses will be more cartelized, and its workers more unionized, perhaps under the shadow of direct government direction. And it will devote a much larger share of its income to saving and investing. Fourth-turning America will begin to lay out the next saeculum's infrastructure grid, some higher-tech facsimile of turnpikes, railroads, or highways. The economic role of government will shift towards far more spending on survival and future promises, defense, public works, and far less on amenities and past promises, elder care, debt service. The organization of business and government will be simpler and more centralized, with fewer administrative layers, fewer job titles, and fewer types of goods and services transacted. Meanwhile, Americans will correct the unraveling's social and cultural fragmentation by demanding the choice that era never offered, the choice not to be burdened by choice. As people again begin to trust institutional authority, they will expect that authority to simplify the options of daily life, at the store with more standardized products, on TV with fewer media channels, and at the office with one pay scale and benefit package. Institutions will be increasingly bossy, limiting personal freedom, chastising bad manners, and cleansing the culture. Powerful new civic organizations will make judgments about which individual rights deserve respect and which do not. Criminal justice will become swift and rough, trampling on some innocence to protect an endangered and desperate society from those feared to be guilty. Vagrants will be rounded up, the mentally ill recommitted, criminal appeals short-circuited, executions hastened. Time will pass, perhaps another decade, before the surging mood propels America to the fourth turning's grave moment of opportunity and danger, the climax of the crisis. A climax takes a form wholly unforeseeable from our advanced distance of 25 years. Imagine some national and probably global volcanic eruption, initially flowing along channels of distress that were created during the unraveling era and further widened by the catalyst. Trying to foresee where the eruption will go once it burst free of the channels is like trying to predict when and how an earthquake will strike. All you know in advance is something about the ingredients of the molten climax, which could include economic distress. With public debt in default, entitlement trust funds in bankruptcy, mounting poverty and unemployment, trade wars, collapsing financial markets, and hyperinflation or deflation. Social distress, with violence fueled by class, race, nativism, or religion, and abetted by armed gangs, underground militias, and mercenaries hired by walled communities. Cultural distress, with the media plunging into a dizzying decay and a decency backlash in favor of state censorship. Technological distress, with America imploding into crypto-anarchy, high-tech oligarchy, and biogenetic chaos. Ecological distress, with atmospheric damage, energy shortages, and new diseases. Political distress, with institutional collapse, open tax revolts, one-party hegemony, major constitutional change, secessionism, authoritarianism, and altered national borders. Military distress, with war against terrorists or foreign regimes equipped with weapons of mass destruction. During the coming fourth turning, some of these climax ingredients will play little or no role at all. Others will shoot along channels that swell, diverge, and reconnect in wholly unforeseeable ways. Eventually, all of America's lesser problems will combine into one giant problem. The very survival of this society will feel at stake as leaders lead and people follow. Public issues will be newly simple, fitting within the contours of crisp yes-no choices. People will leave niches to join interlocking teams, each team dependent on and trusting of work done by other teams. People will share similar hopes and sacrifices, and a new sense of social equality. The splinterings and complexities and cynicisms of the unraveling will be but distant memories. The first glimpses of a new golden age will appear beyond, If only this one big problem can be fixed. Decisive events will occur, events so vast, powerful, and unique that they lie beyond today's wildest hypotheses. These events will inspire great documents and speeches, visions of a new political order being framed. People will discover a hitherto unimagined capacity to fight and die, and to let their children fight and die, for a communal cause. Thus will Americans reenact the great ancient myth of the ekpyrosis, a cataclysmic death leading to rebirth. Thus will we achieve our next rendezvous with destiny. For a brief time, the American firmament will be malleable in ways that would stagger today's unraveling era mindset. Everything is new and yielding, enthused Benjamin Rush to Jefferson at the climax of the American Revolution. So will everything be again. The prospect for great civic achievement, or disintegration, will be high. New secessionist movements could spring from nowhere and achieve their ends with surprising speed. Even if the nation stays together, its geography could be fundamentally changed, its party structure altered, its constitution and Bill of Rights amended beyond recognition. History offers even more sobering warnings. Armed confrontation usually occurs around the climax of crisis. If there is confrontation, it is likely to lead to war. This could be any kind of war, class war, sectional war, a war against global anarchists or terrorists, or a superpower war. If there is war, it is likely to culminate in total war, fought until the losing side has been rendered nil, its will broken, territory taken, and leaders captured. And if there is total war, it is likely that the most destructive weapons available will be deployed. With or without war, American society will be transformed into something different. The emergent society may be something better, a nation that sustains its framers' visions with a robust new pride. Or it may be something unspeakably worse. The fourth turning will be a time of glory or ruin. What will propel these events? As the saeculum turns, each of today's generations will enter a new phase of life, producing a crisis constellation of boomer elders, midlife 13ers, young adult millennials, and children from the new silent generation. Every generational transition will contribute to the shift in mood from unraveling to crisis. As each archetype asserts its new social role, American society will reach its peak of potency. The natural order givers will be elder prophets, the natural order takers, young heroes. The no-nonsense bosses will be midlife nomads, the sensitive souls, the child artists. No archetypal constellation can match the gravitational capacity of this one, nor its power to congeal the natural dynamic of human history into new civic purpose. And none can match its potential power to condense countless arguments, anxieties, cynicisms, and pessimisms into one apocalyptic storm. Think of all the boomers, 13ers, and millennials you know or know about today. Picture them 10 to 30 years older, pursuing the archetypal paths of ancestral generations during prior fourth turnings. This will be America's next crisis constellation, capable of propelling America into and through the next great gate in history. The bulk of today's gerontologists and demographers do not yet grasp what's coming when boomers enter elderhood. Ken Dykewald's Age Wave and Cheryl Russell's Master Trend create the impression that boomers will be much like today's busy senior citizens, except better educated, more selfish, and, an easy prediction, much more numerous. This kind of forecast leads to the conclusion that early next century, younger generations will be overwhelmed by extravagantly doctored, expansively lobbying, age-denying old people. To support their consumptive, sharper-image lifestyles through old age, boomers would have to impose confiscatory taxes on younger people. This would be an enormous dead weight if it ever happens. It won't. Clues of what old boomers will be like can be glimpsed in the conscious aging movement. Cutting-edge books like From Aging to Saging speak of new spiritual eldering institutes, teaching people to engage in vision quests. These new elders of the tribe see themselves as wisdom keepers, who must apply their dormant powers of intuition to become seers who feed wisdom back into society and who guide the long-term reclamation project of healing our beleaguered planet. Boomer gerontologist Harry Moody sees a 21st century shift to a contemplative old age that eliminates today's focus on activity and instead transcends doing in favor of being. Elders will be defined as spiritually gifted over their juniors who are too busy to cultivate the quietness and inwardness from which mystical experience is possible. In sharp contrast to the youth-emulating, uninhibited octogenarians of Gail Sheehy's Silent Generation, these new Earth sages will want to be authentically old people, critical links in human civilization, without whose guidance the young might sink into Philistinism, but with whom the young can craft what gerontologist David Gutman terms the new myths on which reculturation can be based. A New Age gerontology is similarly rediscovering the spiritualism of female aging. In Goddesses in Every Woman, Jean Boland describes gatherings where postmenopausal women enter underground ritual caves. Sitting in a sacred circle, they light candles to enable each participant to claim the traditional wise woman as her new self. There is talk of stripping negative connotations away from words like crone or witch. At the onset of old age, boomers will do what they have done with every earlier step of the aging process. They will resist it for a while, then dabble in it, and ultimately glorify it. Boomers will establish elegant new insignia of advanced age, flaunting, not avoiding, the natural imprints of time. Rather than trying to impress the young with GI-style energy or silent-style cool, old boomers will do so with a zen-like serenity, a heightened consciousness of time. Slow talking, walking, and driving will become badges of contemplation, not decline. The ideal of advanced age will not be the active and leisured GI, or the empathic and expert silent, but rather an elder who thinks deeply, recalling Emerson's view that, as we grow old, the beauty steals inward. The very word retirement will acquire a new negative meaning, connoting selfish consumption and cultural irrelevance. The elder goal will not be to retire, but to replenish or reflect or pray. The very concept of any retirement will fade. As boomers pursue new late-life careers, often in high-prestige but low or non-paying emeritus positions. Aging boomers will be drawn to the classic. Their late-life cultural questing will not evoke juvenescence, as it did in the Awakening era, but rather a preservation of values that will increasingly seem old to others. Boomers will rail against pop culture detritus left over from the unraveling. Violent films, shopping malls, convenience stores, packaged throwaways. Under their stewardship, Hollywood will establish standards of taste while making definitive films of great literature and biography. While boomer elders will still make heavy demands of the young, the nature of those demands will differ greatly from those imposed by today's elders. Where the Awakening-era GIs burden the young fiscally, Crisis-era boomers will burden the young culturally. They will reverse the coin of elderhood from what they will remember of the Awakening. Where GI elders once obtained secular reward in return for ceding moral authority, boomers will seek the reverse. Accordingly, grandchildren will not look to them for financial advice, as per GI seniors, or emotional support, as per the silent seniors, but rather for guidance in the realm of ideals and values. To young eyes, old boomers will appear highly eccentric. What boomers feel as inner warmth will feel cold to others, and what they see as ethical perfectionism will sometimes strike others as hypocrisy. In the fourth turning, boomers are likely to occupy the vortex of a downward economic spiral. This will happen partly because of their numbers, but mainly because of their location in history and collective persona. There will be a payback for the boomer tendency to graze on a problem until they finally decide to focus fully, at which point their sudden discovery becomes as much the issue as the original problem. Sooner or later, the truth will dawn on boomers that the money simply won't be there to support their accustomed consumption habits in old age. Neither they nor their nation will have saved enough. From this sudden realization could issue the endgame of boomer lifelong consumption and saving habits, the Great Devaluation. At long last, aging boomers will focus on the hard fact that a newly endangered America truly cannot, and younger generations will not, make boomer old age subsidies its top public priority. This realization will render boomers jittery about preserving the remaining assets. Some unforeseeable happenstance could spark a precipitous market sell-off, as old investors will want to liquidate their equities to a shrinking universe of buyers. The main domestic buyers would be 13ers, who will have lower incomes and far fewer assets than boomers, and who will be of no mind to take risks with wobbling markets. Foreigners will be hesitant to acquire more U.S. assets in a time of pending fiscal crisis, especially with so many of their own societies facing similar demographic problems. A brief but precipitous panic will ensue. Years of savings could vanish in a matter of days or hours. The great devaluation is likely to hit boomers just as their first cohorts are reaching the official ages of retirement, long before Social Security is now projected to go into official bankruptcy. Indeed, the panic could be triggered in part by the crystallizing financial anxieties of leading-edge boomers. The flashpoint may well occur when the new elder mindset of the 1943 Victory Baby cohort combines with the new demographic realities of the large 1946 Baby Boom cohort to reach a critical mass. This is likely to occur a few years before or after 2005, probably between 2002, when the 1943 cohort reaches the IRA distribution age of 59 and a half, and 2008, when the 1946 cohort reaches the initial Social Security eligibility age of 62, the age at which over two-thirds of Americans now start receiving benefits. Unlike their predecessors, boomers will consider their old-age finances to be more a private than public concern. For GIs, Social Security has been a generational bond running through government, its monthly checks a standard-issue badge of senior citizen equality. For the silent, Social Security will have been a play-by-the-rules annuity, offering a mixture of delight for sneaking through just in time and guilt for burdening their kids. For boomers, Social Security will be the object of fatalism and sarcasm. Some will get it, and some won't. The typical boomer will live on bits and pieces of SEP IRAs, KEOs, 401ks, federal benefits, and assorted corporate pension scraps that will vary enormously from person to person. For many, it will add up to a lot. For many others, nearly nothing. When the market hits bottom, millions of boomers will find themselves at the brink of old age with far smaller nest eggs than they ever expected. They will immediately have to make do with steeply diminished material consumption. Many will have no choice but to live communally or with their adult children, while groping for ways to preserve a meaningful life on very little money. Following the great devaluation, boomers will find new ethical purpose in low consumption because, with America in crisis, they will have no other choice. To maintain GI-style elder dependence on the young, boomers would have to wage political war on their coming-of-age millennial children. It is a war they will not wage, and would not win if they did. Instead of political battles with other generations, boomers will engage in moral battles among themselves. Those who retain assets will accuse those who don't of irresponsibility and lack of thrift. Those who don't have assets will accuse those who do of having battened off the corrupt old order. Younger generations will agree with both accusations. In the end, the next New Deal will find all boomers, rich and poor, paying a price. Many who spend a lifetime paying steep Social Security and Medicare taxes will be substantially excluded from benefits by an affluence test. Those who still qualify for public aid will receive a much worse deal than their GI parents did. The debate will rip apart whatever remains of the old senior citizen lobby built by GIs back in the awakening. The AARP will survive only by reinventing itself as a council of elders committed to advancing the needs of posterity. Modern Maturity magazine will have to shift its style from silent hip to boomer classic, and change its title to refer to aging in more traditional and less euphemistic terms. The next New Deal will render the boomers' old-age healthcare subsidies a tightly regulated social decision. Crafting necessity into virtue, boomers will deem the postponement of death as not a public entitlement. Many elders will eschew high-tech hospital care for homeopathy, minimalist self-care, and the mind-body techniques Deepak Chopra calls quantum healing. Despite the boomers' larger numbers and longer lifespans and the costly end-of-life technologies that medicine might then offer, the share of fourth-turning national income that will be spent on federally subsidized elder health care will fall below what it was in the unraveling. Old boomers will construct a new social ethic of decline and death, much like they did in youth with sex and procreation. Where their youthful ethos hinged on self-indulgence, their elder ethos will hinge on self-denial. Old age will be seen as a time of transition and preparation for dying. With the same psychic energy with which they once probed Eros, boomers will now explore Thanatos. As they fill the upper age brackets, boomers will believe themselves to be elders who, in the words of anthropologist Joan Halifax, function like old cobblers and dressmakers, sewing us back into the fabric of creation. They will feel a new transformative dimension of time, enabling them to craft myths and models that can re-sacralize the national community, heal its dysfunctions, and grant moral authority for the next golden age. The very otherworldliness that boomers will regard so highly in themselves will strike younger generations as evidence of incompetence. Their contempt for this world will strike younger people as dangerous. Yet regardless of what you think of these old messengers, they will respect their message and march to their banner. Thus will the gray champion ride once more. 8 or 9 decades after his last appearance, America will be visited by the figure of an ancient man, combining the leader and saint to show the spirit of their sires. Whence will come the gray champion? Picture the boomer overclass of the unraveling, aged another 20 years. Picture Bill Bennett's consequence and confrontation missives, Al Gore predicting an environmental cataclysm, James Webb's summoning a ruthless and overpowering retaliation against foreign enemies, James Fallows rooting for a 7.0 magnitude diplo-economic shock, Apocalypse Darman and Default Newt with their budget train wrecks, Earth First saboteurs willing to sacrifice other people's lives to save trees, and Army of God anti-abortionists summoning the terminally ill to use your final months to torch clinics. Picture all these boomers, older and harsher, uncalmed by anyone more senior, feeling their last full measure of strength, sensing their pending mortality, mounting their final crusade, all at a time of maximum public peril. The full dimension of the boomer persona will only emerge when today's better-known 1940s birth cohorts, whose youth was marked by relatively few social pathologies, are joined in public life by the tougher-willed, more evangelical 1950s cohorts, whose youth was marked by many more pathologies. That is the mix that will beget this generation's elder priest-warrior persona, vindicating the early unraveling-era warning of Peter Collier and David Horowitz that boomers are a destructive generation whose work is not over yet. As the crisis deepens, boomers will confront the end result of their lifelong absorption with values. The habitual boomer tendency to enunciate unyielding principles will now carry the duty of enforcement. In domestic matters, old boomers will recast the old arguments of the culture war into a new context of community needs. In foreign matters, they will narrowly define the acceptable behavior of other nations, and broadly define the appropriate use of American arms. The same boomers who in youth chanted, "Hell no, we won't go," will emerge as America's most martial elder generation in living memory. Whatever the elements of crisis, old boomer leaders will up the moral ante beyond the point of possible retreat or compromise. The same boomers who once chanted, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, the NLF is gonna win," will demand not just an enemy's defeat, but its utter destruction. They will risk enormous pain and consequence to command youth to fight and die in ways they themselves would never have tolerated in their own youth. They will believe, as did Cicero, that this moment in history assigns young men for action, old men for counsel. As the crisis resolves, elder boomers will not have the last word, but the deep word. If they triumph, they will collectively deserve the eulogy Winston Churchill offered to Franklin Roosevelt, to die an enviable death. If they fail, their misdeeds will cast a dark shadow over the entire 21st century, perhaps beyond.